It's Wednesday, October 9th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. It's a fascinating period for news. Hurricane Helene, new polls, Kamala Harris doing a series of interviews with friendly media and one on 60 Minutes, Donald Trump speaking before crowds at rallies, having declined the 60 Minutes interview after they denied his request of no fact-checking. But the news I am most fascinated with, to the point where I'm going to talk about it here and in this spiel, is not really new news, it's old news. It's of an ongoing case, an attempt by the state of Oklahoma to execute a man named Richard Glossop. He is on death row, and they have tried to put him to death over and over again. In the spiel, you get more details of the case. It is a miscarriage of justice, I believe, were he to be put to death. And not just according to me, a person who is pretty liberal type of guy on criminal justice issues and anti-death penalty. So all death penalties are a miscarriage of justice, in my view. But even to the Republicans who dominate Oklahoma state politics, this is wrong. They want to spare Glossop to, in a way, save the reputation of the death penalty. One strong argument for abolishing the death penalty everywhere is that that's the only real way to stop innocent people from being executed, a total ban. Richard Glossop would be a powerful posthumous example of just that. And no one could say, well, we didn't find out about it until it was too late. So in the spiel, I will talk about the truly important considerations of the case. This right here, isn't that? There are a couple of odd details, interesting, I think, details of this case. And here's what specifically I've been a little bit more interested in than the overall, bigger, more important overarching issues. Glossop is 61 years old. He's on death row. He has been married twice on death row. His most recent wife is a paralegal, the former Leah Roger, who was 32 years old when she married Glossop 2 years ago. And I have to report, it's my duty to flesh this out, she is quite pretty, perhaps beautiful, depending on your gaze. I know, don't comment on the looks of women, but I think if you look her up, you're like, wow, she married a guy on death row. And as I said, it was Glossop's second marriage. Sky News did a 10-part series on Glossop a few years ago, and in the last episode, introduced us to the first Mrs. Glossop, also named Leah Glossop, after being married. And here she is speaking about the first time she was able to touch her husband, which happened to be her wedding day.
It was surreal, it was. We were very nervous, both of us. I think everyone could tell, but it was really nice. It felt natural, too.
The new Mrs. Glossop, Leah Jurassic, is a 21-year-old student who's training to be an undertaker and works in a funeral parlor. She'd read about his case, began writing to him, and it developed into a relationship.
She's just such an incredible person, and there was something about her right away that just her and I connected. And we've been together ever since. We haven't never looked back.
That Leah Glossop, upon divorcing Richard, claimed he took her for $7,000, asked for alimony, and quote, stirred up animosity for me amongst his online following. Who could have foreseen that marrying a man 35 years your senior on death row was not the fairy tale that you had been promised? But I don't really know what it means. We see this phenomenon a lot. It says less about Glossop than the type of woman who marries an inmate, which is to say many women, perhaps many types of women. Ted Bundy got married while he was on death row. Lyle and Eric Menendez, the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, all were betrothed while in jail. It is fascinating, fascinating psychology at play. But so ends the exploration of human nature and onto an analysis of the criminal justice system. It's more substantive, I promise, and that's the spiel. But first, Arlie Russell Hochschild is an American professor emeritus of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the new book, Stolen Pride, Lost Shame and the Rise of the Right. We shall talk about the pride paradox, how Donald Trump shifts shame to blame, and how the people view Trump as the good bully. Arlie Russell Hochschild up next. presidential elections turn on many factors. I talked recently about an academic who listed 13 factors. Is the person an incumbent? Is there a scandal in the air? What's the state of the economy? And that's all true as far as it goes, but you really want to know why people vote especially for a presidential candidate. They vote for feelings. They vote for the feelings that he or she invokes, but that also means the feelings that he or she can tap into, can trigger the feelings that are already there. And the feeling we're going to talk about today is pride. Arlie Russell Hochschild, Professor Emerita at UC Berkeley, is a chronicler of the hopes, dreams, aspirations, and feelings of Trump America. Her new book is called Stolen Pride, Lost Shame, and the Rise of the Right. Welcome to The Gist.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. You went to Louisiana to figure out what the Tea Party held for many of these people who are left behind by the economy. And then, in your most recent book, a similar but slightly different excursion to Appalachia and the 5th Congressional District in Kentucky. Tell me what new findings you were seeking to find that the Louisianans didn't have for you.
First of all, it was later in time, and the issue had changed to the very importance of voting and democracy. You know, do you want an autocracy or do you want democracy? So the issue was different. The region was different. And while the circumstances were similar, I wanted to develop a new perspective, this perspective on pride and shame. It's kind of underdeveloped in my last book, and I was trying to really etch it out and get clear on how we could become kind of bilingual, how we could hear a political rhetoric with an eye to the emotions being appealed to, in this case, shame.
Yeah, bilingual is an important point that you get to, but I want to hone in on the fact that you chronicled Louisianans. And I have to tell you, during the Trump presidency, your interviewing of them were so often cited, I think, is a very useful explanation to get into the mind of the kind of person who would like Trump, even though your interviews then weren't about Trump. And now you did these new interviews. Did you say to yourself, the occasions told me something, and so I expect to find a lot of that with the Kentuckians?
I was open to that, but I felt that I could hear differently because I was trying to tune myself in emotionally differently. And indeed, I did find some differences in strangers in their own land. I came up with this approach of the deep story, where people are kind of, what is a deep story? Politically, the right-wing deep story isn't about precepts. It isn't. It's about what the world feels like to you. And you're waiting in line patiently. You don't feel you have any animus toward anyone else. As you feel it, you're patient, you're looking to the American dream, but you can't get there. The line isn't moving. And then there are these line cutters. Who are the line cutters? They are women. They are minorities. They are immigrants, so well-paid public servants, even animals that are endangered. People say, oh, the liberals value the animals more than us. And then a president, a Democratic president, is privileging these groups over you. That is the right wing deep story. And when I ran that by the people I came to know in Kentucky Congressional District 5, the whitest and second poorest congressional district in the country, they said, well, yeah, that's true for us, but there's one thing else. There's in line, there's a bad bully that seems to be allowing these line cutters. And then there's a good bully. We know the good bully is a flawed person. Oh, we know he lies. We know this about him, but he's our bully. use. So that's a change in the deep story that I discovered this in this new book.
So the fault, we hinted at what Democrats can do not to shame a prideful people. Part of it is, I think, when MSNBC does a segment, they're not thinking about the viewers, these kind of viewers. And also, they're being honest, and they do think it's abysmal that Donald Trump would tell five congressional female representatives to go back to the countries from which they came when all but one were from this country. They can't not say it. They have to say it. They say it at the highest of dudgeon. And it leads to, in the manner, however this gets filtered to Kentucky Fifth, it leads to the cycle. So I would think that if they cared about, and media's job is not to elect politicians. So their job is not to assuage the electorate, just to tell the story and give their opinions when it's an opinion segment. But if they were to do things differently, I think it would have an effect. But what about leaders? What about just average citizens? Things that we could all do a little bit differently so as to not push these prideful people in a corner from which they come out fighting.
Yes. Well, the media, I think we have an opportunity, I think, in front of us, a big one. And the media could play it differently, and so could we as individuals and voters. I mean, I think between now and the election, a lot of us should get to the crossover states and go door to door in getting people to vote. But in the meantime, also to just understand that we haven't been tuning in to a sinking, a large sector of society that's been sinking. We haven't been tuning in for decades now. And there's to our detriment, and it's not too late to start hearing how they're feeling now. And there's a lot of which we're not so good at doing on the liberal side. We're less open than on the conservative side, believe it or not, even though we believe in being open.
Yeah. Democrats, studies show Democrats are more likely to cut off contact with someone who disagrees with them politically. Democrats understand the right less than the right understands the left. And there are huge gaps in ignorance or gaps in understanding both ways. But that is just the fact.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. There are a lot of crossover issues. I met one of my most conservative people I met was helping a undocumented worker that happened to be a waiter in a Mexican restaurant. And he loved the food. And turns out he really befriended this guy. So he said, oh, he's so hardworking. We should work as hard as this guy does. He's mowing his lawn on Sundays, living with his brother, and life is hard. And then COVID came, and the undocumented worker got COVID. And this MAGA guy said, well, you know, I called him up and said, if your temperature gets over 100, you call me. I'll get you help. And he's trying to help the guy get his documents. So he's also something of an environmentalist. So I'm a coal guy. He advocated for mountaintop removal. You know, doesn't matter how you get that coal out. But now he's for putting windmills and solar panels on top of these sawed-off mountains. So he, you know, it would count in a way as someone who could really cash in on Biden's Build Back Better bills and is looking it over. So you could have a conversation on certain issues with this guy.
Right, right. And it, you don't say that just to redeem him or to establish him as an interesting character, although you do. The point is that all of these people, so many Americans, no matter how in of one stereotype you think they are, everyone has these cross pressures and cross currents, and there are reachable elements to almost everyone that if a Democrat were just writing off Kentucky's fifth, or those like them, don't, because there are people who would listen to their the Democratic agenda if there were people speaking their language. Being bilingual is how you call it. Now, what about
exactly? Many, you got it.
Many left-leaning people do think about, and maybe they don't think that deeply, but they know. Many of the white nationalists come from places like this, or if they come from anywhere, it's a place like this. What about it were someone to say, fine, the people in Kentucky's fifth, they have whatever reasons they have or whatever story they tell themselves, but, you know, they are racist. And that is something I don't want to deal with. You did trace white nationalism, some of it, back to Kentucky. What did you find? How should we think about that?
Trace white, you know, it's interesting. I wrote this book at this time. There was a white nationalist march coming to this beleaguered town and county and congressional district. His name was Matthew Heimbach, and he turned out, oh, spoilers for the book here, to be doing a trial run for the bigger and more deadly march in Charlottesville a few months later. And so he came with a dozen far-right groups. The group was armed, all dressed in black, looked fierce. And he was a neo-Nazi. And I interviewed him. You know, why are you a neo-Nazi? Can we talk about this? Turns out he was on the spectrum. He said, well, I'm high functioning and I, you know, tend to have a riveted kind of worldview. And he, as things came out, you know, I noticed he had a certain relationship to shame. He said, my father is of German heritage. Heimbach's a German name. I will not be shamed. You know, by that. My mother comes from the South, you know, and kind of a Confederate heritage, but I will not be shamed. He kind of got stuck on that thing. And so I've interviewed him a bunch of times, and actually he's changed. A lot of people have changed. And one of the paradoxes, the center of this book, is that the neo-Nazi leader of this white nationalist march that was offering a racist solution to very real economic and cultural problems changed his mind. He was looking now into a job in nursing, and he didn't change all the way, but he did change. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, through the new period, through the same period of time, had started more moderate, was getting more and more extreme. And he's now invited a neo-Nazi to Mar-a-Lago. And he's hanging out with the Proud Boys and defending them, wanting, if he's elected, to free them from jail. So there was a strange crossing of lines, which suggests that these positions are more fluid than we usually think of them as.
Yeah. Although, if people were to say Donald Trump tells the Proud Boys to stand down and stand by, and invited or at least hosted Nick Fuentes, who, by the way, doesn't endorse Donald Trump anymore, and Trump says he was kind of tricked into it, but Nick Fuentes shows up at Mar-a-Lago, and therefore we should denounce Donald Trump for their association with white nationalists. Even the people who aren't white nationalists, even this guy, Matthew, who this high spectrum functioning former white nationalist, they'll still trigger that pride cycle that you talked about. So you can't just foursquare demand Donald Trump disavow this part of his personality or his agenda without getting into the same problem we're talking about.
That's right. And if we're looking at a pragmatic shifts, I think we need to look at the middle part of the political spectrum. We need to look at people who have voted for both Republican, Democratic candidates in the last 10 years, and people who were independents and undeclared. And if you put all of those categories together, it's about a third of the non-voters. That's about a third of Americans.
Yeah.
So those are the people to talk to.
I want to ask you just a couple questions about your techniques. First of all, are you the coiner of the phrase emotional labor? Does that come from you?
Yes, it does.
That's pretty good. Now, were you trying to? I know columnists, and they want to sometimes get a phrasing, a coinage in the ether. Were you trying with that one?
Coinage in the ether. I was just trying to give language, and I, you know, been at this for a while, to what I saw that emerged in a totally different context. A book called The Managed Heart, which was about flight attendants and bill collectors and the emotional labor I think capitalism kind of needs to get its work done.
So when you go in, does the phrase occur to you, or does it pop out of someone's mouth, or do you think about it and work it over and say, what is the pithiest either headline or encapsulation of what I'm trying to capture?
Well, I'm a slow worker. Mm-hmm. I love to hear stories. I love to hear stories of people's experience. I love doing field work. That's why I'm still doing it. Then I think about what people have told me, you know, take it to heart myself to try. And then I'll wake up in the morning, you know, with the phrase or something, and over breakfast, talk it over with my husband. It goes like that. But I come in there, you know, not as, you know, the detached scholar. I come in there, you know, trying to look for common ground. And during the summers, I, you know, would visit my grandma in Maine on her, you know, this small dairy farm. And she put me to work, weeding the broccoli. And she had a regional accent. My name was Ali. Oh, Ali, could you, you know, look at the weeds in that broccoli? What do you think? You know, better get at it, you know, teaching me hard work. So I come in with those stories, you know. We're not that far apart somehow.
I was in Maine and they told me something about the lobsters. I forgot what it was. And they say, well, some on. with this book, did you have pride as an idea going in? Did you say there's something with pride that I have to get to?
Yeah, and that came from kind of the stories I heard in Louisiana. I mean, one of the first things they would say is, well, why are you coming? And I'd say, well, I'm worried about the divide in this country. It's getting worse. And they would immediately say, oh, well, that's because your people, you Democrats, you know, you look down on us. You think we're backward and uneducated and prejudiced. And you know, we don't like it. And you have a stereotype about us. And then I could say, well, you know, I've long taught sociology at Berkeley. There's a stereotype about people like me, too. And we would have that stereotype in common. And you kind of start with looking for common ground. And that doesn't mean that you don't disagree and feel strongly about the issues you disagree on. The empathy bridge, as I've come to call it, isn't about agreement. It's about coming to respect each other equally so that you get a avenue through which both people can hear what the other one is saying.
How is sociological field work different from a well-resourced reporter?
Just this way. I think it is crossover. I mean, there's some journalism that I've really put down in the book and thought, awesome, this person is doing just what I do.
Yeah. Catherine Boo, right?
Yes.
Right? Yes. She's, I read her, I read you, I say to myself, how are these two people in different
They
fields?
Aren't. No, yeah. Not at all. I think it has to do with listening, not being afraid of listening. I guess when I go into the field, I think Catherine must do this too. You just take off your alarm system. So that the whole stance of being responsible for your mouth and kind of that you want to announce yourself and defend your status is removed for a period. And with that guard down, there's a lot more color and noise in the world.
Yeah. Put aside a bit of your hubris, a bit of your ego, a bit of your, dare I say, pride.
Yes, exactly. Bingo. That's wonderful. Yeah. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's exactly right.
And if you want to hear more from Arlie Russell Hochschild, and you should, subscribe to the Pesca Plus feed. We go deeper into specific elections, how she traced white nationalism back to Kentucky, and this. Are you the corner of the phrase emotional labor? Does that come from you?
Yes, it does.
Yes, she created the term emotional labor. Learn more about that and how to get the show without ads and with bonus features by subscribing to Pesca Plus at subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. A Baconator sandwich from Wendy's, a pizza, a strawberry shake, and fish and chips. That was Oklahoma death row inmates Richard Glossop's last meal. And then it was again his last meal and his last meal for a third time. You should know that Oklahoma has a $25 cap on last meals. That one man should have been so close to death three times tells us something about his case. It was stayed, it was appealed, and today is once more before the Supreme Court. The most important thing to know is that I can unequivocally state that Richard Glossop is in prison for the 1997 murder of motel owner Barry Van Treese, despite the fact that he did not kill Barry Van Treese. This is actually not in dispute. It's also different from being guilty of murder or not under the law. The state of Oklahoma has maintained that Barry Van Treese was killed by a man named Justin Sneed. Sneed carried out the murder, but Glossop was convicted of convincing Sneed, a mentally ill man, to carry out the murder. The evidence does seem to indicate that Richard Glossop did no such thing as instructs Sneed to carry out the murder. The only real evidence connecting Sneed to Glossop was Sneed's testimonies, but prosecutors didn't disclose that Sneed had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and prescribed lithium after his arrest, and then Sneed lied about ever seeing a psychiatrist, psychologist, or getting that diagnosis. Prosecutors misled the jury as to ledgers, which they said indicated that Glossop was stealing from the motel, i.e. the motive. But there seems to be much, much stronger evidence that Glossop never did steal. And Sneed's own daughter wrote to state officials, quote, "For a couple of years now, my father has been talking to me about recanting his original testimony." Remarkably, in Oklahoma, a state quite comfortable with the death penalty, those state officials did hear her out. Republicans, pro-death penalty Republicans in the state legislature, looked at the case and concluded that Glossop was wrongly convicted. One such official, Kevin McDougall, was on the Murder Most Foul podcast talking about his fellow elected officials taking them into the state execution chamber to convince them that an injustice was being done.
And I wanted, because we're making decisions on a daily basis in the House of Representatives that affect real people. And I wanted them to feel what it's like. And the main reason I did that was to tell the story of Richard Glossop.
McDougall isn't the only one, nor is he actually the most important one. The Attorney General of Oklahoma, the state's Attorney General, Republican Attorney General, barely needs to be noted in Oklahoma, Republican, Gentner Drummond, took the case to Oklahoma's Supreme Court. But that body narrowly denied Drummond's request that Glossop get a new trial and release from death row. The U.S. Supreme Court has also in the past denied Glossop his request of not being killed. That last case that the court heard was based on the method of lethal injection being cruel and unusual. Now, at the time, 2015, Justice Samuel Alito spoke for the majority.
Is it appropriate for the judiciary to countenance what amounts to a guerrilla war against the death penalty, which consists of efforts to make it impossible for the states to obtain drugs that could be used to carry out capital punishment with little, if any, pain.
The 2015 case was not Glossop specific. It was brought by four inmates. But by the 5-4 ruling, the court declared that that method of lethal injection was permissible. The opinion was one of the nastiest, okay, let's say most contentious ever issued by the court, with Justice Antonin Scalia calling Stephen Breyer's reasoning, quote, gobbledygook, and saying that Justice Sotomayor's words were, quote, outlandish rhetoric. Sotomayor is still on the court today. Of course, she and her two fellow justices certainly are inclined to support Glossop. And so was, in today's testimony, it would seem, Brett Kavanaugh, who dug into Oklahoma's contention that a jury, knowing that the main witness has lied, was irrelevant. Here's Kavanaugh.
Would have made the conviction more likely if the jury knows that not only does he have an incentive to lie, that he's lied on the stand and that he's bipolar, therefore creating all sorts of avenues for questioning his credibility.
It should be noted that Justice Gorsuch has recused himself in this case. That said, a 4-4 decision would still damn Richard Glossop to death and presumably his fourth, quote, last meal. The verdict is expected in June. That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara, senior producer Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Leo Baum's our intern. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, Jeeperu, Duperu. Thank you for listening.